Welcome to The Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston. Now, as well as presenting the podcast, I'm also working on the third in the series of Lost Lane cycling guidebooks. Having covered southern England and Wales and the marches, the next volume is all about cycling in the West Country. And it's a great place to ride, from the wild uplands of Dartmoor and Exmoor to the flatlands of the Somerset Levels, from wind-blown Salisbury Plain to the lush hills of West Dorset and the rugged Cornish coast. Devon is the West Country's biggest county, and it's something of a mecca for cyclists. While England's other biggest county, Yorkshire, has spent millions bringing big bike races like the Tour de France to its country lanes, Devon has taken a different route over the past 20 years, quietly building a remarkable network of traffic-free bike routes. And among the longest of these is the Devon Coast to Coast, which runs for 99 miles, 160 kilometres, from Ilfracombe on the north coast to Plymouth on the south coast. And a couple of weeks ago, I rode the Devon Coast to Coast. And this time, I rode it as a family cycling tour, along with my wife Sarah and our two children, our son Lewin, who's 3, and our daughter Rosa, who's 11 months old. And we were joined by our friends Adam and Sarah and their daughter Annie, who's 2. Well, Sarah and Adam are with me now. We're sitting outside in Sarah and Adam's garden. And we're going to talk about cycling the route and what it's like to go cycle touring with young kids. As well as that, we're going to be hearing from some of the people at Devon County Council who have built the county's enviable network of traffic-free cycle paths. Well, welcome all to the Bike Show.
Thank you.
Hello.
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 Let's start by giving a bit of background of the kind of cycling that we've been doing with our families. They're pretty young, our kids, and I know there are families who'll think nothing of strapping their babies to their backs and riding across the Atacama Desert with nothing more than a sack of lentils in their saddlebag, but that's not really us, is it, Sarah B?
No, not really. We tend to go on sort of local bike rides and use the bike to take our daughter to nursery. We haven't really attempted any long bike rides as yet. This is our first, isn't it? So it was...
Yeah, most rides up until now have been to the shop or a couple of hours to a ride around the local country lanes or to a pub somewhere. So to take Annie on a bike ride for a few days seems like a bit of a challenge at first, but I guess we'll talk about how we overcame all of that stuff.
Well, let's talk about getting packed up and how we got the kids on the bikes and how we carried all the stuff that we needed for what was a four-day trip. There are lots of ways you can carry kids on the bikes. I mean, ours are young enough that they can actually go on the bike. They have to go in a bike trailer. I had Lewin, who's 3, on the back of my touring bike. And unfortunately, the seat means that you can't put panniers on the back. So I had to put a set of panniers on the front and fill those up. And then, Sarah, you had Rosa on the front of the bike.
Yes, so I had to almost lean over her while I was riding, which was actually really lovely because it felt like I was protecting her, and I could chat in her ear and point things out to her and, you know, just rub her hands and communicate.
And Annie was on the back of your bike, Adam.
Yeah, that's right. She's in quite a simple, lightweight child seat that hangs off the back, but I didn't have any kind of pannier fixings on my road bike, so the rest of the luggage I was carrying was like a dry bag between the drops on the front.
So, because you were riding your Brian Rourke road bike, 25mm tyres and no mud guards.
That's right, yeah, I was trying to keep it as lightweight as possible.
And so that meant that you, Sarah, were carrying the luggage?
Yep, that's right, I had 2 panniers and a rucksack that we tied round the top of the rack on the back. So yeah, I think I got the tough deal because I think the luggage is heavier than Annie.
I think it works out about the same.
So we'll drive cars as well as riding bikes, and when you go somewhere in the car with kids, it's easy to kind of fill the car up with kind of child paraphernalia, isn't it? It's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. I was surprised at how I wasn't actually that daunted by the prospect of cycling with Annie on the bike for a few days. In terms of what we had to take, I found it quite liberating to kind of whittle it down into as little as we needed, And it kind of really suited my love of writing lists and whittling it down to as little as possible.
Because it's really easy when you're going away with kids to just sort of pack that thing. Oh, well, I'll just take that just in case. Oh, that extra pair of shorts, I'll just put those in and blah, 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 blah. But when you've got just a couple of panniers, or in our case, we had four panniers between us, you really have to think carefully and count out, OK, how many T-shirts do they really need? And then do it like that, especially with ours, because, we had two.
Yes, our children looked really filthy at the end of our journey, but, you know, so did all of us. So it didn't matter.
That's harsh. I think we did all right. They got a nice wash on the last day anyway, but we'll come to that in due course.
I say that's a tricky thing, isn't it? Because you're trying to pack for all eventualities and weather, essentially, and you can't. And we were fairly lucky with the weather, weren't we? So, yeah, you had to really, go minimal.
I mean, I think with anything, with your cycling with kids or without kids, list making is really helpful because that really does focus your mind and keeping to the list once you've written it rather than just sort of say, oh, I could squeeze that in, oh, I could squeeze that in as well, is an essential discipline. I mean, there are people who always used to say, if you want going on a cycle touring trip, just put everything out on your bed that you want to take and then halve it. But I think the list is maybe a bit more strategic.
Yeah, I think the list worked well, doing all that organisation beforehand. I think we kind of prioritised Annie's clothes and equipment and all that stuff. So she kind of had priority in the panniers. So we took the bare minimum, perhaps a little bit more than we needed just for her. Then any space left over was for me and Sarah to, you know, take a spare pair of socks or pants, exactly.
It was really great going with you guys, knowing that had we forgotten something, someone else might pick up the slack. So going with another family really kind of enhanced the experience as a whole and made lots of things perhaps seem just a bit easier because you'd know that you'd somehow manage to get out of any situation.
Yeah, we could swap nappies and...
Which we did. You had the first aid kit, and also Sarah B had lots and lots of snacks, which was
always.
Yes. And the children still associate her with
dispensing another mini rice cake.
Yes.
No, well, that's definitely a key thing for morale boosting is the snacks. We'll come to that in a bit more detail. But in terms of route planning, I kind of thought through what we should do because I knew we wanted to do this distance, and we try and ride for 3 to 4 hours a day, not in a single block, and about 25 to 35 miles that would be, and that's a lot less than I'd normally ride while touring, but with kids on board it seemed as though the day passed very very easily with that kind of distance. It didn't feel like, oh, it's lunchtime, we've arrived. It felt like any more than that it would have felt like we'd have been really under pressure, so that was felt like a good distance, and the terrain was, there were some hills along the way, but a lot of the path is along old railway paths, so it was quite flat and easy going. So that was kind of quite sobering to think that 25 to 30 miles was probably about right to aim for.
Yeah, I think so. I think we were quite conscious that we didn't want to push it too far because the kids were just in the seats. We didn't have a trailer, so there wasn't like an opt out to go and lie down and sleep. So I think like the 3 hours, as it worked out, was probably the limit we could do with the kind of the seats we had and keeping the kids happy.
And they certainly enjoyed being in a bigger group. We just mentioned that it was good for point of view of if we forgot something that you guys might have it. But the kids seemed to enjoy the fact that there were other children other than their own sibling, and that we were sort of part of a gang going along. And I know Rosa, who's only 11 months, really enjoyed sort of seeing Adam pulling alongside or Sarah and just kind of little hoots of pleasure as we all reconvened and rode along in a little group.
Lots of waving practice, clapping practice, Adam, lots of actually we noticed that she developed a lot. She had definitely had mental leap and physical leaps.
Yeah, because she was up on your handlebars. So she's on one of the bow bike seats, which is just behind the handlebars. It fits onto the stem, and she's got a little handlebar of her own that she can kind of hold on to. And she was right up top because babies spend a lot of time in pushchairs or on the floor where they're not really at eye level with everybody else in the community. So once they're kind of up on the front of the bike, mm-hmm. it did seem as though she was, you know, she was part of the gang, which yeah. I think she really enjoyed, and it really created a, well, as you said, a mental leap forward.
And she felt like an equal, and it was amazing to see how much she could anticipate, like the actions of dogs coming along the road or even going uphill and then knowing that the hill was about to come. She'd taken a deep breath and like let out a shrill laugh as we'd be speeding down. So it's amazing to actually sort of almost be that close to your child, because she's too big now to really have in a sling for long periods of the day. So it was amazing to have that connection again with her on the front of the bike.
So we began our journey from Barnstaple. The official route does start at Ilfracombe, but that route is quite hilly, so we decided to skip those hills that are on country lanes and start at Barnstaple, which is still kind of on the coast, so we could count it as a coast-to-coast. And we rode along the Tarka Trail, which goes all the way along the estuary of the River Torridge, and named for Tarka the otter, who's the animal character created by Henry Williamson, who was inspired by a lot of the landscape in that area, but maybe a little bit further inland beyond Biddeford. But it was a lovely way to start the ride, wasn't it? Absolutely pancake flat, huge views out to sea, out into the estuary, boats, wildflowers. Really gorgeous, gorgeous bit of cycleway, wasn't it?
I had no idea what to expect, really. So it was a really nice sort of gentle easing into the first sort of few days, really. Yeah, very flat, beautiful views. It was just, yeah, really gentle and a great way to start the journey.
But tell us a bit about the flora along the way, Sarah, because that's your special field.
Oh, well, I kept stopping, which was probably quite frustrating for everyone, because they had giant dandelion seed heads, tragopogon or salsify, and they're these amazing, they're bigger than a tennis ball. And I was collecting lots of seed heads. There would be like fields of purple vetch everywhere.
Loads of oxeye daisies.
Oh, loads. And then we'd go near some like little cottages, which would be kind of coastal cottages painted with bright blue walls. Sarah took a lovely photo of like poppies and just this mix up of annuals and just very, very charming.
Well, it's the easiest thing in the world to ride along one of these paths. It's an old railway line that's been converted to a bike path and a walking path. And it seems like the most logical thing to do to convert these disused railway lines. But the reality is that it's a really hard thing to actually make it happen. There are all kinds of constraints, from fragmented land ownership, the difficulty of negotiating to buy or lease the land, getting the planning permission, winning over the locals, setting aside the necessary budget, and then building the thing. So let's hear from one of the people who's taken a leading role in developing Devon's network of traffic-free cycle trails. And this is Roger North of Parsons Brinkerhoff, who led the project team working on the X Estuary Trail, which is in some ways very similar to the Tarka Trail, but it's over by Exeter. And it goes all the way around the Ex Estuary from Exeter down to Exmouth and back again on the other side past Powderham Castle.
Well, there was quite a lot of private land and substantial sections of land owned by Network Rail where there's been no public access at all. And so one of the first elements we had to deal with was negotiation with landowners in order to allow a cycle route to go across the land.
And so what kind of political direction was there from the council to say, okay, we want to do this, it's really ambitious, and we want to have a circular route all around our estuary and we want you to make it happen? What kind of direction and backing were you given from the politicians and the senior officers in the council?
Well, Devon County Council were very keen to have the trail, and in fact in the very early days, we're looking back now before 2004, they had the trail indicated as a felt tip line on a plan as part of their local transport plan. But we then had to move that as engineers and planners into something which was realistic, hence the early days of discussing with landowners and getting the planning applications in order to be able to build it.
And so what do you say to a landowner? You go along to Mr. Landowner or Mrs. Landowner and say, we want to build what we're on now here is a sort of tarmac path. We were on some gravel a little bit earlier, or a great big bridge. Yeah. What do you say to them? How do you make that approach?
Well, first of all, there may be already a public footpath along there, and you'd have to negotiate with the landowner whether they were willing to have that converted for use by cycles. And part of that includes public access and the contractor's access in order to build it. And there's an element of negotiation and funding to allow that access to be developed.
So you make them an offer that they can't refuse?
In essence, yes. We were very reluctant to go to any compulsory purchase orders. And it's true to say, for the whole of the Ecclesiastery Trail, we've not had to resort to any compulsory purchase orders at all.
What other considerations and what other challenges did you have to face? What were your biggest headaches and proudest achievements in this, in making this trail what it is today?
Well, the main one really is how wonderful the Ecclesiastery is. And it is wonderful because it has some very special designations. It's designated as a special protection area for birds. It's a site of special scientific interest. It's also a Ramsar site, which is a wetland habitat legislation. And we had to make sure that we weren't disturbing the wildlife and the bird life on the estuary in building this trail. So a lot of our design and features revolved around not disturbing the birds in order to gain that approval from the authorities.
Were there any logistical challenges and construction challenges that were difficult and required some creative thinking?
Yes, indeed. On the far side of the estuary, where we're going shortly, most of the land was actually owned by Network Rail alongside their existing operating railway track. So clearly there were constraints from the operational side about how and where and how near we could build it. From an ecological side, we were very constrained by which time of year we could build, so we didn't disturb the winter birds that migrate down into the Ecclesiastery. So a lot of constraints on the timing issues and where we could actually build the trail.
And was it a fun project to be on? I mean, how does it compare to the other kind of things that you manage as big infrastructure projects?
Well, I think I mentioned to you before, I'd done quite a lot of work out in the Far East, based in Hong Kong. And I must say, of all the projects I've worked on, this is one where I've received probably the most supportive comments from members of the public at how wonderful and how much enjoyment they're having from the project.
And here we are, we've arrived at another, some sort of, what's this, a tidal lagoon, or is this the canal?
This is the canal that runs from Exeter all the way down to Turflock and then out into the estuary. And again, it's a popular spot. You can drive a car here, and a lot of people will come down here with their bicycles on their bicycle racks and then set off and cycle up and down the trail here. There's quite a good viewing facility over here because behind us there's this wetland habitat. It's all managed by the RSPB, and again, that's all part of the issue of trying
to... Oh yeah, look, and right on cue, is that heron standing there proudly in the flooded land.
You can see some egrets and quite a lot of Canadian geese come by here as well.
I mean, I'm not an accomplished bird spotter, but is this a real destination for the twitchers here?
Very much so. I'm not sure they like that terminology too much, but certainly these Exminster marshes is a brilliant area for lots of birds, and the many, many occasions you'll see people with a large cameras and long telephoto lens coming here to look at the wildlife here.
Well, I beg their pardon, bird spotters, not twitchers. I had no idea.
That was Roger North talking about his work with Devon County Council on the Ex-Estuary Trail over in the south-east of the county. And we were, of course, cycling down the Tarka Trail in the north of the county, which is in many ways a very similar kind of trail. And I imagine it had a lot of the same kind of challenges in terms of gaining access to the land, planning permission and all the rest of it. But for us, it's already been built, it was plain sailing. And as we carried on past Bideford with a tremendous view across the river and that spectacular bridge there to Bideford, we didn't actually pass through Bideford because the route goes on the other side. Suddenly the landscape changed from this marshland, very open kind of salt marshes and big tidal estuary into a much closer landscape of really lush woodland, with the river keeping us company. And that was a really glorious and enchanting bit of the ride, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was really, really beautiful, and they must have had a lot of rain a few weeks beforehand because there was a lot of water coming down, and the kids could peek right over the side of the bridge from their bike seats and watch the trees and the stuff being swept down the river. It was good fun.
And we spent the night at East Yard, which is at a place that's right on the trail. It's called Yard Orchard, and it's one of these businesses. There are many of these businesses that either were started up or revived or could only exist because of a cycling and walking trail that goes right next door to them. And they were a little cafe with some camping, a very small campsite, enough room for three or four tents. They had a few little yurts out the back, and we had a couple of yurts. And it was a really nice place to stay. It felt like kind of easy version of camping, which I suppose is what they call glamping.
It was, it was lovely. We stayed in the yurts, and the kids absolutely loved them, and being able to run between the two that we were staying in. So there was lots of sort of the exploration of the outdoor space. There was a little stream, a small kind of wooded area, I guess, and there was an outdoor kitchen that we made full use of, which worked out great. Obviously, we were lucky with the weather, so that helped.
Yeah, and this place was right on the trail. You really couldn't miss it. I think we got there a little bit late, and the guy there who runs it, he was really helpful. He stayed open and he met us there, and he sold us some provisions for dinner, and he sold us some beer, and it was a really lovely little spot.
We had considered going camping and taking tents and all that, which is sometimes a nice thing to do, I think, with kids, because it means you're all together. You can put them to bed in the tent and you just hang out outside the tent. You don't have this thing of sort of putting them down in a hotel or a B&B and then just thinking, oh, what are we going to do now? It's kind of 7 o'clock, but we can't abandon them and wander off to the pub. And then you're just kind of stuck in the B&B with the residence lounge and the ticking clock and a kind of sort of sense of general ennui and emptiness for the evening. I'm clearly drawing on some sad past experiences of bed and breakfast. They're not all like that, I'm sure. There are some excellent residence lounges available. But we ended up basically not doing the camping route. We kind of came to a group decision that wasn't going to be a good thing. From my point of view, it was this sheer amount of luggage, but there's also the possibility of it was going to pour with rain, and just added to the complexity, didn't it, really?
I think we wanted to camp. I think that felt like in keeping with the nature of the holiday. But the amount of luggage it would require was a bit too much. And we were trying to keep things as light as possible. And it would have been cheaper as well than staying in those B&Bs. And I think the kids probably would have enjoyed it a bit more, like you say.
Yeah, I don't know. They quite enjoyed discovering the like little mini kitchen in the B&B, the kettle and the biscuits, and then discovering the beds and the strange sleeping arrangements. But I think it was almost lack of confidence for my part. I wasn't confident that I'd be able to carry more luggage because my baby, well, Rosa is 11 months and she's huge. And I also had, she is big, I also had luggage. And I just think the prospect of having more to carry, and also I haven't been cycling for the last 3 years very much since I've had children. So I think it was just the confidence of how exhausted are we going to be when we arrive somewhere and having to set up a campsite. And I think now going forward, it actually wasn't exhausting and it was fun and they all loved it. So, yeah.
We looked into some possibilities for kind of vehicle luggage transfers, and there is a company that operates in Devon, and their quote was pretty reasonable. We sort of said, oh, if we each have a very large kind of hold all, like up to, I think, 20 kilos in weight, which is definitely enough for a tent and all the camping gear and stove and all that kind of stuff, they would have charged £32 for each transfer from each night to night for those two bags, for total price, and that seemed reasonable. But then there was the problem of how do you get everything back at the end, because we did have to take the train back, and that would have been a big extra bag to have taken on the train. So it is possible to do it in different ways with camping, and you don't necessarily have to carry everything if there's a company that's going to be able to provide luggage transfer or just a helpful local taxi firm. Because also if the distances you're doing are 25, 30 miles, it means that your transfer cost is that much less. Whereas if you were doing 100 miles in a day and paying for a transfer, then that's quite a big taxi drive. So it's definitely worth bearing in mind the possibility of doing kind of vehicle-assisted transfer, although that doesn't seem very ecological. It just kind of feels like David Cameron cycling to work with the ministerial car driving along behind carrying his stuff.
As good as the B&Bs turned out, it still wasn't the easiest option. There was quite a lot of research in finding somewhere that would take kids for a start. But also because we kind of did it over a weekend, a lot of places wanted us over two nights, and that just wasn't feasible with our plans. So there was a bit of trial and error in ringing up places and seeing if they would have us.
Well, let's carry on to the next bit of the trail, which is from East Yard to lake just beyond Oakhampton, right in the heart of Dartmoor, and that carried along the Tarka Trail for a bit and then went on some quiet lanes around Hatherley where it got a bit hillier, but it was really quite beautiful and you had this distant view of Dartmoor kind of before you and you kind of knew where you were going, and it had that feeling that you get from cycling that you don't get from a walking holiday, where you can see right into the distance and you think, God, that looks like a long way away, but we're going to be there in 2 or 3 hours. And I remember you, I think you, Sarah, yeah. Is that where we're going?
yeah, like I said, this is our first cycle touring holiday. And yeah, you said, oh, look, we're heading over there. And that to me looked hundreds of miles away. I couldn't quite get my head around the idea that we would get there by the end of the day. But we did, which which was good. And it was lots of really beautiful lanes. I think this particular day, Sarah pointed out the hedgerows and kind of really, they were kind of flourishing at this time of year and really beautiful to look at. There's quite a few uphills, not that many uphills.
Quite a few.
How many miles did we do?
That was quite a long one, was it? That was 58 kilometres, I think, on that second day. It was quite a long one.
Yeah, I think it was the hills around Hatherley that made it feel a bit longer. I think that felt like the most tiring of the day.
And then there was a big climb out of Oakhampton up onto the Granite Way.
Yeah.
Morale was low at that point. We were trying to make it up to the youth hostel in time for some ice cream, and we weren't sure if we were going to get there in time, but luckily we did.
And we were massively rewarded by the Meldon Viaduct in the kind of glorious late afternoon sunshine. And that's the start of the Granite Way, which is another old railway line that takes you from Oakhampton to pretty much to Lidford, the old Saxon capital of Dartmoor. And that viaduct is just a wonderful curving structure made out of iron and utterly breathtaking to cycle over.
It was great, and I think we got all the kids off there and we hung around for quite a while. There's a few old train carriages and remnants of the train track there, which the kids could have a look around as well.
And there's a really good viewing platform, which you can climb down to, and so you can kind of get a good vista looking up towards the bridge as well, so you can really appreciate the engineering.
I mean, one thing that I found that was quite nice about cycling with children was that you stopped a lot more than you would normally, because you have to. They need a wee, they need to walk around, they want to have a look at something, a closer look, and you're conscious of the fact that they're not pedalling, so that they, you know, it's a bit dull for them to sit on the back of the bike for hour after hour. So you do feel like you're going to stop every 20 minutes, half an hour, and for maybe 5 or 10 or 15 minutes. And that actually changes the way you experience the places you're passing through, because you have time to stop and look around and wander down a lane into a field or just the kind of things that if you were just kind of on the road, it's very easy to get that feeling when you're cycling by yourself or just as grown-ups, that you just want to keep going and you mustn't stop. And kids kind of give you a way of getting out of that mentality of keeping on moving.
Yeah, I also think there's that classic thing of kids make you kind of like live in the moment, and they really do. I thought a lot of the cycling just went by really quickly, and I think in kind of an adverse way, that was because we were stopping a lot. And when I've cycled with Adam, just the two of us, we're kind of almost trying to get to the destination, whereas you're literally enjoying the ride for where you're going to go next. Like with the kids, you're kind of enjoying the actual ride itself for what it is, and stopping to look at some sheep or stopping to go and paddle in a river or stopping to go for a wee because you're potty training your kid on a bike.
It shifts your mentality, because I'm definitely one of those cyclists that just wants to not stop, just keep going as far as I can or as fast as I can. So the idea that I've got someone singing and shouting behind me that they want to stop or they want to go back and look at something, you kind of have to forget all of that, and it forced me to kind of be a lot more leisurely, and it was good for that.
Also, on a sort of slightly selfish level, as a mum that has two young children, I was able to talk to Sarah rather than, like, usually when we meet up we're constantly being interrupted, but somehow because we were cycling with the kids we could talk more and have proper full conversations, which was really lovely.
Yeah, it felt really and liberating and easier. We were saying it felt easier than day-to-day childcare because the freedom that you feel when you're cycling a bike anyway, you have that, but then obviously you're experiencing it with your children, so you're having the most fun form of looking after your kids, essentially. It felt really easy in that respect. You weren't stuck at home looking at the washing, thinking, it's raining outside, what am I going to do with my child today? It's, you know, you were outside experiencing all weathers and sharing it with friends and your kids' friends, which can only be a good thing, really.
Well, I'm glad you guys got to have a full conversation because I think maybe it's because me and Jack had Annie and Lewin on the back, but when we were cycling side by side, we had constant renditions of Bar Bar Black Sheep and other versions, and Lewin constantly ringing his bike bell. So,
but the Granite Way there takes you right into the heart of Dartmoor, I think 2 or 3 miles from Dartmoor's highest point, which is actually the highest point in southern England, south of the Peak District. So you get really high up there. And when we stayed for our second night at the Bears Lake Inn, which was a bit of a treat, because that's a kind of a thatched pub with a beautiful garden, and it's got a few rooms upstairs, and it's a sort of dining type pub, but very relaxed, a bit more expensive than a B&B, but I think it was worth it. And it seemed like that was a really easy way of doing things. Being in a pub, you're kind of a bit more relaxed with eating, and then you can put them to bed and then stay down and have a couple more pints. So I think pubs with rooms, if you're not camping, that's probably a good option. So we carried on along through Dartmoor, and Dartmoor is really just such a wonderful place for cycling, whether you're road cycling or mountain biking. And a couple of weeks before we did our ride, I spoke with Richard Drysdale, who's the visitor services manager for Dartmoor National Park, and I asked him to tell me a bit more about what Dartmoor has to offer people on bikes.
368 square miles to explore by bike. Different terrain for you. You've got lovely long rolling parts across the moor, plus challenging climbs, equally exhilarating descents. A cyclist's paradise. Cyclists coming up onto the moor, always welcome. There's fantastic on-road and off-road cycling here. All we ask is when cyclists just come up onto the moor, they enjoy what they're doing, spend some money locally, go and get that refueling stop, have a bacon butty, have a pint responsibly, obviously. But yeah, enjoy Dartmoor for what's there. Stunning light, beautiful conditions, but understand it is a very, very challenging terrain. Make sure you've got the right gear. It can get cold up here, so make sure.
And the right gears.
Right gears, yeah. Actually, right gear and the right gears, and you know how to mend your gears if you have if anything goes there. And that when you're on those roads may be different to the ones you're used to in your town or wherever you've come from. Whereas where I grew up near London, you wouldn't expect to come around the corner and find sheep on the road. You can find that on Dartmoor, so you need to be prepared to brake suddenly, just know how to control your bike and just ride responsibly and be visible and recognise that it's a living, working community. So if you come around a corner that again that you're going down, there will be people who are going about their daily work on the land, and just respect them. There are horses there, people riding the horses. Just a simple wave, hello, just shout out, they know that you're coming up behind them, and that's all they do. Slow down a bit, wide berth. And everyone's very happy. So it's a great way of enjoying the moor.
It's a big area. There's a large amount of it that hasn't got any roads on it at all.
Yep.
And there's a couple of big B roads that sort of crisscross. Yep. And then a lot of little lanes. And we've just come up one of them here, which is absolutely gorgeous in the late afternoon sunshine with the long shadows of the ancient field boundaries. And it's an absolutely enchanting landscape. Do you have any favourite routes of your own?
I do have a favourite, and I put on my Twitter account that I maintain that I have the world's best commute to work. I come down off the High Moor, descend down towards Bobby Tracy. It's stunning in all weathers and all conditions. Big vistas, big long rolling roads. You can see 5-10 miles in front of you. You know where you're going. Yeah, just when you're in the gear and your bike's feeling good, it's just a pleasure to be up on the moor.
And have you noticed an increase in the number of people who are coming to Dartmoor by bike?
Yes, there's definite increase on that. That increases particularly around when we have big events, something like the Dartmoor Classic Sportif in mid-June, and more people climbing here, learning how to climb. So again, when people come up here, it's about enjoy the moor. These events, they're not races. They're up here to avoid the, they're events. So just come out and recognise road rules apply at all times. More people come up. But as I say, yeah, if you come up and enjoy it and take your time, you'll have a great, great experience.
And do business owners, have they noticed the road bike boom, do you think? Do you see a greater awareness of the needs of cyclists and catering for cyclists? I don't know, bigger portions of food, bike racks outside. I don't know what else, public pumps and that kind of thing.
I think there's definitely a rise of the sale of granola bars and et cetera. There are definitely two or three hubs on the moor where people come up and they will know to come up either on club runs or individuals coming up.
Where are those?
Princetown. Princetown is a real hive. You've either done a really good climb from Plymouth or Tavistock to get up to Princetown, you need to have that little break, or you've just done a big loop over the moor and are heading back, you just need to refuel. Centre of the moor, you can stop at the Warren House Inn and have a great view out across the moor before you head either way. Moreton Hampstead, again, is well set up, cafes, pubs, etc., will welcome cyclists.
And the Tour of Britain, you've had the Tour of Britain, you're getting it again. You had the first summit finish of a stage in the Tour of Britain a few years ago. I came down and watched it and it was spectacular. You're doing that again this September. Yep. So it must have been a success the first time to bring them back again.
Yeah, absolutely. We recognised through consecutive years when the Tour was coming back that the crowd enjoyed it, but critically, the cyclists enjoyed it and the event organisers enjoyed it because of the passion of the crowds in Devon. They get cycling, and that those people who come up here, they are they're good cyclists. They know they know how to enjoy themselves and come up. So having the Tour come back up to and have a finish at Haytor is fantastic. It's a great opportunity for lots of people from all over the country, and we know they come from abroad as well now. Come down here, it's that Friday the 9th of September, come here for a long weekend, and really make the most of what Dartmoor and Devon has to offer.
That was Richard Drysdale of Dartmoor National Park. The next section, beyond Lidford through Mary Tavey, I kind of think that was a bit of a missing link in the whole coast-to-coast, at least as in terms of it being an easy, traffic-free cycle route, because it got very rough. We were going basically on an off-road sort of mountain biking track, which, it was quite fun and it was okay, but we were doing it in mid-June, where it wasn't as muddy as it might be. And that section really did seem to be completely out of keeping with the rest of it.
Yeah, absolutely. It was pretty rough in places, and I was quite pleased with how my 25mm tyres coped with it all. I think we took Annie off the seat at one point, and that was mainly due to her own comfort, and she wanted to get out and explore anyway, so we kind of could take our time over that bit, and it wasn't too bad, but after being used to being on the cycle path, it was a bit of a change.
We walked with the bikes for, not for very long, but perhaps for sort of 5-10 minutes, didn't we, just to kind of, go over some sort of more rockier.
And the alternative, there was a kind of on-road alternative, but that was on quite a busy road over a massive hill, so it wasn't really ideal. And then the way into Tavistock was incredibly fiddly. Remember going up and down all those lanes and then getting back up onto the railway line and then losing all the height again. And it felt like that area does need a bit more development in terms of making it a proper coast-to-coast continuous route. So I hope Devon County Councillor are onto that. But once you get to Tavistock, things get a lot better. You kind of pick your way through a typical sort of Sustrans through the back of the industrial estate cycle route, but then suddenly you're onto the river path and railway path and cruising along downhill, because we were coming off Dartmoor really. We were on Drake's Trail at that point, which runs all the way down to Plymouth, and we stopped overnight at Yelverton and had a two-night stay there, partly because I think the B&B wanted us, because it was a Friday Saturday night thing. We also wanted to have a day off to do some exploring, and we had kind of quite a nice day visiting a garden and then going up to the Oak Fair at Meavey, which is a kind of village fete. And just around about Yelverton is, I guess, the highlight of Drake's Trail, which is the Gem Bridge. And this is a stunning brand new bridge that leaps across the steep-sided gorge of the Walcombe Valley, replacing a bridge that was built by Brunel, or designed by Brunel, in the 19th century and destroyed as part of the beaching cuts in the 1960s. And they actually did dynamite it and bring it all down into the valley below, which just seems like the most terrible act of kind of
vandalism of public infrastructure, but it has been rebuilt at a cost of £2.1 million. And it is a stunning bridge, isn't it? Just comes out of nowhere and you're suddenly flying, really.
Yeah, it's completely hidden in the trees, isn't it? And then all of a sudden you're cycling along it and you're at tree level on one side and then you're kind of halfway up trees on the other side, and it's quite a big drop to the bottom.
Well, it's worth noting that that bridge was built at a cost of £2.1 million, mostly funded by Devon County Council, but there was a contribution of £600,000 from the EU. So it does make you wonder whether if Britain leaves the EU, these kinds of projects are going to be a little bit more difficult to achieve, because that source of funding won't be there. But anyway, the Gem Bridge is definitely something worth visiting. So in the last 2 days, we were cycling along the Drake's Trail, which is a really important cycling route into the heart of Dartmoor, because it goes all the way from Devon's biggest city, which is Plymouth, that has a population of 250,000, right into the heart of Dartmoor at Tavistock and beyond Tavistock. And it's clear from the strategy of Devon County Council that it's important to help people get up into the moor by bike. Otherwise, how are people going to get there in the first place with their bikes? They're going to have to put their bikes on the back of the car, and that excludes a lot of people who don't necessarily have cars or don't have cars that they can put their bikes on. And so developing these routes that take you from where people live up into the moor does seem to be at the heart of their strategy. And another route up into the moor is further east from the market town of Newton Abbott, where there's a mainline train station, and that takes you 4 miles to Bovey Tracy, which is sort of where the Dartmoor starts, over in that southeastern corner of the moor, and it follows the route of an old mineral tramway. It's called the Stover Trail, and it's only recently opened, and a few months ago I rode it with Ian James, who's a highways engineer from Devon County Council, who explained to me how they managed to build it.
So it all came as part of the government cycling ambition fund. Devon County Council put together a project called the Granite and Gears, and that improved, or looked at improving, cycling access to national parks. There was a big barrier between Newton Abbott and King Stainton linking onto Dartmoor. So we achieved that by putting the Stover Trail in, which links down through past the old Stover Canal. We crossed the A38, which was a major barrier before. There was an at-grade crossing there, which was very dangerous.
A crossing of essentially a dual carriageway.
Absolutely, yeah, at-grade crossing. So crossing the two live lanes, crossing the central barrier in the middle, and then crossing the two live lanes on the other side. Very, very dangerous. It prevented a lot of people from making that route onto Dartmoor. We then put a new bridge in that section, and then we linked on through then to Dartmoor.
How did you put it all together? Because you had to do it all in quite a tight time frame. You got there was this money from the government, but they said you've got to spend it super quick.
We did, yeah. So we achieved the funding in August 2013. It was part of a £7 million package of works which we put together, which had to be realised by March 2015. We had to change the way we worked. We set up project boards for each individual project and one overarching one. We worked with the local planning authorities, we worked with our contractors to make sure everything was supplied, and we had to work at pace for everything to make it happen. We had to follow all the statutory procedures, but there wasn't any room for errors in any of that to make sure it happened in that particular period of time.
So tell me the kind of things that you have to achieve in that 18 months period.
Particularly with the Stover Trail, we started from literally from a standing start on that. So we had to get the community buy-in with that. We had to speak to the parish councils, the district councils, the landowners, particularly in that one, and also then getting planning permission. The planning permission takes quite a lot of effort with ecology, flood risk assessments, and like I say, obtaining the land and everything in that short period of time. And also making sure in that section, when we were gearing up for a general election, there was lots of works going on in Devon at the time. We had a £110 million bypass that was being built, several other link roads. There's a lot of pressure on local contractors. So it was tying in those local contractors in that period of time to make sure that nothing could go wrong to deliver it in that period. And we were successful. It was all delivered in that time frame.
And we're standing here. You tents are a little bit out of breath. We're not out of breath from cycling along the Stover Trail, because that is pancake flat. And thanks to your surface, it's very nice and smooth. But we've left our bikes at the bottom of this great big hill. It's a beautiful meadow, grassland, gorse growing all around. I can hear a skylark up above. But you're telling me as we're walking up here that this was a tip. once.
Yes, this was the old inert tip for the clay works, from the Imrys Clay Works that was next door to where this was. We worked with the landowner, Imrys Clay, at the time, and also the other landowners, Sibelka, who were next door to this, to provide the bridge either side. We knew with the relationships we'd had with them in the past that they would come good on the deals. This section here that we're on, we actually purchased the whole section of land ourselves as Devon County Council, the whole inert tip. We asset stripped the Hall Road on that, resurfaced that, and then we gifted the rest of the land to the Devon Wildlife Trust, which meant that they opened it up for public access. It's now been rebranded as Teen Grace Meadows, and it's an excellent resource for...
Teen Grace Meadows from...
From Newbridge Tip.
Newbridge Tip to Teen... That's a very astute bit of rebranding. I mean, it feels... amazing place. I mean, we've got Bobby Tracy, kind of, what's that works over there? The British...
So that's the British Ceramic Tiles,
British
BCT.
Ceramic Tiles. And behind that, we've got Dartmoor, Haytor Rocks, a really panoramic view all the way around. So, I mean, this must be a real attraction for this cycle route, to park your bikes at the bottom, you put in some cycle stands at the bottom.
Absolutely,
there,
yeah.
And head for the top of the hill, because you just get a stunning view. Can you see the sea from here?
Yeah, if you look, when we get up to the further higher bits there, you can see the sea on the one side, and you look all around like 360 onto Haytor on the other side. It's one of the best vantage points in the area.
As a highways engineer, you're dealing with all kinds of different projects. How do you, whether they're for people in cars or other bits of infrastructure, how do you get people to prioritise and take seriously something for cycling and walking? Because there's a sense that in Britain, it's the poor relation of the car and the road.
As Devon County Council, we've got a very good reputation with the DFT, and when we bid for money, we make sure that we've always got the ability to make those things happen. We're not putting anything in that's unrealistic. So it generally comes down to the way we organise ourselves. We work with a private sector partner, which takes up slacks and bulges in our work. We've also got contractors already on board under framework contracts, so we can move really quickly. We have to move at pace with the schemes that we're doing to make sure they happen.
And do you think a scheme like this is a kind of vote winner from the politicians? You mentioned election years and that kind of thing. Politicians like to deliver big road projects, bypasses, new link roads and that kind of thing. Do you think this kind of cycle trail makes people think, yeah, they did a good job, the County Council, I'm going to back them again, or just feel that their taxes are being well spent?
I think so, yeah. I think it's such a good win for everybody. I mean, this route's used by tourism, it's used by locals, it's used for commuting. So it's a really good win for everybody. It gets people out, it's on the health agenda as well.
And are you able to measure any increase in cycling? Any increase in cycling tourism, or people using a bike to get to work or go to the shops? Is that something you can actually measure and quantify?
Yeah, it is. We have cycle counters installed on most of our cycleways, and all the new infrastructure that we put in, we have that, and it's monitored, and you can see an increase certainly on that. And certainly talking to locals of how much increase they've had in trade, there's certain places where we've put trails in and there were businesses which were failing, particularly like food outlets, pubs, etc., who have suddenly seen a massive increase in trade. They've had to take on extra people to cover the extra trade which they've got. There's also, if you look at things like the Strava heat map, you can see on there the trails that we've put in are being massively well used.
That was Ian James from the Highways Department at Devon County Council. And it is quite interesting to hear about all the work that goes on behind the scenes, sort of beneath the surface, to produce these cycleways that we enjoyed last month.
Yeah, absolutely. And to hear how sort of enthusiastic and positive people are about or doing the work to get to that point, because you always kind of hear about lots of red tape and how difficult these things are. So it's really refreshing to sort of come across a council who are so willing and supportive to kind of push these schemes through and make them happen.
And when you're cycling along them, it's the last thing you're thinking about, isn't it? So
yeah, I mean, I was struck over the time that I spent with Devon County Council. I was taken around by Visit Devon to see a lot of the new stuff that they've been built and meet the people who did it, by the entrepreneurialism of these guys and these women, who they see a problem and it just makes them more hungry to get it done, because they think, well, how can we solve this problem? And people say, oh, that's a can-do attitude. And so often you feel that there's a can't-do attitude in local authorities, that as soon as there's a little bit of a bump in the road, they say, oh, well, we can't do that. And that's just a quieter day for them because they don't have to get involved. But there's a completely different attitude. It feels as though success breeds success. And Devon has got this great
reputation with the Department for Transport, so it tends to win the bids that it puts in, because it's all done with competitive bidding. The Department of Transport opens up a fund and says, bring us your bids, and then hands out the money. And ultimately, Devon have got it cracked. They've got a long-term plan of what they want to do. They do as much of it as they can beforehand to make sure that it's kind of on the shelf and ready to go, shovel ready, I think. And then the moment that the funding door opens, they've got everything lined up so they can come in and say, okay, we can do this, we can deliver this. And by the way, we did these over the last 10 years, so you can trust us. And it's no surprise that they get all the money. It's really interesting. And I don't know whether other local authorities have been down to Devon or go down to Devon to find out the secret of their success, but they really ought to, because I don't think there's anywhere else that I've come across that is as good as doing what Devon's been doing.
No, they definitely seem like they're leading the way with that kind of stuff. And you're right, all the other councils should follow their lead as close as they can. But
it's also slightly sort of depressing. On the other hand, while it's inspiring that they do what they do, it's sort of depressing that it relies upon a county council being kind of innovative and entrepreneurial, rather than there being a bit more direction and a bit more help from central government to make these things happen, and not just rely upon there happening to be a good team, you know, in one part of the country or another part of the country. And if you look at all the difficulties of getting the planning permission, winning over the local support, making sure that ecology is sorted, that the birds aren't going to be disturbed, and you compare that to what is done for road building, where the costs are much higher and the environmental disturbance is much greater, they sort of plough ahead with it and get it done really quickly. But when it comes to a cycle and walking trail, it's like, oh, excuse me, mind if we put in a, I'm sorry, no, don't worry. It seems a very kind of different approach to providing this kind of infrastructure to providing the traditional road infrastructure.
Well, it was interesting what that guy was saying. It was a vote winner, in a way, in Devon at least. So maybe that's the kind of mindset that other councils should be taking.
I guess for Devon, a lot of their economy is always relied on tourism, so that is a kind of a lead, you know, that's a priority, isn't it, for the local authority there. They have to kind of build on that, so they've already got that as a starting point, whereas I guess not to justify the kind of less can-do attitude of other authorities, but they've already got that.
Yeah, because I think they were very keen to build on their tourism but take it out of the hotspots, right, and direct people up into the sort of interior, really, so that farms that are struggling can set up a camping barns or B&Bs or farm stays, and that they can benefit from a different source of income. That was definitely the genesis of the idea. But I think it sort of evolved. And if you look at something like the Stover Trail, connecting Bubby Tracy with Newton Abbott, that's used by commuters now. So the final day, it was actually a final half day, was from Yelverton down to Plymouth. And we'd been very lucky with the weather. The forecast hadn't been good for the whole week, but it finally did turn bad on that last day. And we sort of cycled through the rain, the mist, the mizzle and the drizzle, and got thoroughly wet, because it was pretty much a monsoon by the time we arrived in Plymouth, wasn't it? It was kind of quite an epic end to a very non-epic trip.
Yeah, I think due to how we packed, the kids remained pretty dry, pretty happy, but the rest of us were pretty drowned by the time we got to the train station.
But the kids didn't seem to mind the rain, did they? Because I thought, oh, this is child cruelty. Because yeah, they were wrapped up and they did have the full waterproofs, but it did look like it was damp, you know. Waterproof is never completely waterproof, but they were smiling, particularly Rosa, 11 months on the front of the bike, getting quite a lot of water in her face as well, was just laughing through it all.
Yeah, it was warm rain. I think that made a big difference, to be fair. Yeah, and again, maybe the fact that we were all cycling together and we were part of this journey made it seem exciting, and they like swimming, and
yeah, I think it reflected well on us as well. None of us got too grumpy. It wasn't quite grim, but it was heart-going in places.
I think at that point it felt very much, being the last day, and it was very much obviously a downhill coming from Yelverton into Plymouth, it felt very much we just needed to get to a destination on that day. It was less about stopping, meandering, a kind of everything and everything. Because obviously, you know, the rain makes your visibility, you know, in terms of being in your eyes, you can't sort of look up and around as much with hoods on, and
Yeah. It was very murky as well. There was a sort of mist everywhere. You couldn't really see anything, and
yeah.
It wasn't highly scenic. I'm sure that's a lovely route. Although it did feel like it was a little bit one of those ex-railway line routes that is a bit of a green tunnel, because that's what was striking about the routes, particularly the Granite Way up in the heart of Dartmoor, was that there were tremendous vistas out on either side, and you didn't feel like you often do when you're cycling along one of these old railway line tracks where you're just stuck in a green tunnel, and you could be anywhere. You could be in Essex, you could be in Liverpool, you're not seeing anything, you're not going through real places. We've got a bit of noises off there because we are sitting out in the garden here, but that was a real pleasure of most of the off-road sections, was that they were very, very scenic.
Yeah, it was really scenic, and the fact that we were off the road as well meant there was no cars or trucks overtaking us, so the pressure of being cycling on the road with the kids was completely gone, and we could just cruise along. You could use the whole width of the cycle path without too much care of what was around us, so it really did make for quite a stress-free kind of ride.
I think that'll only become a more important consideration as kids get older and they want to ride on their own bikes, because you can rig up child bikes with so you can tow them along for some of it and then they can ride themselves. I wouldn't really want them to be riding along country lanes. I mean, first of all, it's a bit hilly in Devon, but also there are tractors, there are big trucks on some, even on some of the small lanes. So looking to the future for other routes that I'd want to ride in this way, I'm really going to be looking for traffic-free trails or largely traffic-free routes.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the fact that hopefully in a few years to come they'll be on their own bikes, I think it's great that they can use that path and be confident on the bike without having to worry about the traffic. And then as they get older, we can push them out onto the road a little bit more and hopefully they'll get on well. But yeah, it's kind of like a training ground, those kind of paths.
So as I said at the very beginning of our chat, this was all new to us. This was very much a first time cycle touring with children experience, and I want to do a quick reflection on what we have all learnt and what we would change or do differently or do the same if we were doing it again.
Well, I think the biggest surprise was how well the kids all cope with it. I think it definitely helped that Annie and Lewin are a similar age and they got on so well and spent so much time together. I think they definitely benefit from that. But I do think that was probably the extreme of what we probably could have gotten away with. I think Annie was coming down with a bit of a cold towards the end. And I think if we'd done another couple of days on top of that, things might have changed and this would be a very different account.
Yeah, it did seem that 3 to 4 days was about the limit because they kind of eat into their sleep reserves. I mean, that is the tricky thing, isn't it? Finding the time for them to nap, because Rosa was falling asleep on the front seat and we had to prop her up with a coat all wrapped up but probably not getting the best sleep of all time. And the kids are just so excited and having such a great time that there's inevitably a kind of payback.
Yes, I think if we were to do it over the course of a week after maybe 2 or 3 days, or the third day, we'd definitely have to stay somewhere for 3 nights and just sort of stay put and let them recoup a bit and settle before we'd then go off again. But we definitely had a come down from being away, all of us. Like, we all wanted to get back on the bikes as soon as we got back home, which was...
And Rosa's so excited to get on the bike, isn't she? Kind of take her out into where the bikes are and she sort of starts to wriggle and wants to get on board.
Growls.
And starts growling and wriggling.
She definitely knows the word bike.
And rice cake.
Yes. You were an absolute hero on the provision of snacks, and I think we didn't really plan very well on that, so we really relied on you. So I think next time we pack a lot more snacks. What do you think are the best snacks for kids while cycling? There were a lot of rice cakes going down, weren't there?
A lot of rice cake action going on. What else do we have? Some kind of goodie bars, organic goodies bars. Oat cakes, yeah.
Anything not too chocolatey or sweet.
Dried fruit, yeah, raisins, apricots, yeah.
Have you got any ideas of where you'd like to go next, having done the Devon coast to coast?
Well, it's definitely given us a lot of confidence as a family to explore more of these types of holidays. We're definitely looking at going into France, maybe even continuing that kind of trajectory from Plymouth, getting the ferry and venturing into Brittany.
Yeah, because the route does, it is a kind of official route that takes you all the way across Brittany, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I think you can just keep going straight the way down to the Mediterranean if you wanted to. But we thought about going to Holland maybe next year, and even just when we travel around the UK to friends and family's houses, you know, we're probably more likely to take the bikes with us now and explore what's around and making full use of it, especially now we know Annie loves it so much. So,
I mean, another practical point that I guess we should mention is how you get back at the end of the journey. And we were able to get back on the train with a stop and change at Exeter. But it was not without hassle, was it? Because you have to book bikes on Great Western Railways and they only take two on each train, and then you have to take your chances with the line that goes up to Barnstaple. It didn't feel like the easiest end to the journey. In fact, the relief of arriving in Plymouth Station and being in the dry after the monsoon was sort of soon gave way to kind of, oh God, how are we going to get our bikes up and over on the lifts, and are we going to make it onto the trains in time? We had to split up into separate, you went ahead and then we came on behind on the following train. And it's all just a little bit more difficult when you've got kids, because you're kind of rushing down the platform to get the bikes into the guard's van. And it's all those little things that you sort of get used to when you're cycle touring by yourself. But then when you've got kids involved, it sort of just becomes a little bit more difficult. I found.
Yeah, absolutely. It is logistically more challenging, that's for sure. But I did feel perhaps, I don't know if you did, with having the kids, there was more sympathy to allow you to give you more time. They held the train for you guys to get on so you could make the connection. So I feel there is encouragement and support there, but there's a long way to go to improve that, I suppose.
It also made me think about planning future routes like this. Unless you do a circular route, which I guess is the alternative, is if you're doing a linear route, then you do really have to think about how you're going to get back again. Mm-hmm. People can sort of park a car at each end, but then that becomes quite tiresome when you've got to, you know, shuttle back and forth to pick up cars and things like that. So ideally, a train line, a single train line without a change that brings you all the way back to the beginning is ideal. Mm-hmm. So that would definitely play a part in my thinking about whether to do future journeys. I mean, actually, I was thinking, well, we live here in Abergavenny in the Black Mountains and the Brecon Beacons National Park. I was thinking, well, you know what? The next journey I'd like to do is just one from our front door, and just or just a short way from here, because it did feel like a little bit of a trek to get down to Devon and then get back again afterwards.
Yeah, it did. Having said that, I think it was worth it, and I think we'll do it again. I think it was such a good route. We had such a good time. I think the train it was a little bit of a hassle, but it wasn't. It wouldn't put us off doing it again.
Yeah. And in a way, those challenges kind of add to the general experience, don't they? You know, you kind of, they do, don't they? You know, they can't.
You're very
all be.
Glass half full today. No, I need to up my game, don't I, really?
The hardships make you appreciate the positives, and, you know, it's all about that balance. And I think, yeah.
Annie really enjoyed it. Annie was not stressed about getting on the train. And who went on the train first? The panniers, the bikes, or Annie? You know, none of that was, she wasn't considering any of that. She was just happy to look out the window and study the chocolates on the trolley that came past. You know, that made her day. So,
well, thank you all. I hope you've enjoyed our reflections on cycling the Devon coast to coast with a handful of babies and toddlers. My thanks to Adam, Sarah and Sarah, and also, of course, to Lewin, Annie and Rosa for coming along for the ride. You're listening to The Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston. That's it for this week. Tune in again next time, and hopefully we won't have this catastrophic drilling sound. But until then, goodbye.